Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As NATO leaders mark the 70th anniversary of the alliance with meetings in London this week, President Trump, who's called NATO obsolete, took a different tone today.
NATO's come a long way in 3 years, and it's become very powerful. I think very, very powerful.
When he says NATO has come a long way, he's likely referring to other NATO countries spending more on defense. This has been his main criticism of the alliance, and he repeated that again today. Joining us from London, BBC defense and diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus. And Jonathan, so President Trump saying positive things about NATO. Countries are paying a little bit more. Some people said that a commitment started in the Obama administration, but it does reflect well on Trump.
Look, it's clear the row over spending, burden sharing, as it's known, with America footing far too much of the bill, long predates the Trump administration. It goes back to the Kennedy era. So it's always been a nagging problem. The difficulty is that Mr. Trump has brought his own very particular kind of abrasive rhetoric to this issue. And to be fair to him, in response, many European NATO countries are beginning to spend more. The graph line is upward. They're not spending enough yet. So Mr. Trump did begin by trying to set a more positive tone. The difficulty is that he almost cannot stop himself. He invariably then descends into the traditional criticisms, the belief, as he stated again here in London, that the Europeans get a lot more out of NATO than the United States does, which is an extraordinary statement, I think, for Europeans to hear. And of course, there's been the very public dispute between Mr. Trump and the French president, Monsieur Macron, who recently described NATO as strategically brain dead. Mr. Trump described these as nasty comments. So sadly, at a moment when NATO is hoping to project unity, it seems to be actually projecting quite the contrary, a rather serious and deep divisions.
I want to take up the relationship between Trump and Macron, but I don't want to let thought hang there. I had said that some of the spending dates back to the Obama era and a request that countries pay a certain percentage more. Some analysts are saying they are responding to that, but you're also saying, as others are saying, that many are responding to Trump and paying more of their fair share as well. So he can claim credit for that. But you mentioned Macron. The president was sitting next to him, and the body language was interesting. We're hearing that Macron has decided to pick up on a little of President Trump's forcefulness, some could say bullying, with comments like, you know, NATO is brain dead. What's your sense of what's happening between the two men?
I think President Macron really feels that this constant talk about money is rather trying. He pointed out when he spoke after meeting with Mr. Trump in a bilateral session this afternoon that France's debts were being paid equally in blood. France recently lost a significant number of soldiers in its operation, its counter-terrorism operation in Mali. And Mr. Macron was very clear. He said that France, you know, is paying its way. It isn't just about money.
Well, when you're saying, you know, he wants the focus to shift from money, it's two things like, well, Russia and President Trump's unilateral decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria, which has led to, you know, Turkey attacking the Kurds in northern Syria. Is this also on his mind?
Absolutely. Mr. Macron is very annoyed about what he considers to be unilateral actions taken by the United States and by Turkey. America in pulling out partially and abandoning the Kurds. Turkey in actually moving more troops and more allied forces into northeastern Syria. The problem, of course, is, as Mr. Macron quite pointedly said, standing next to Mr. Trump, we have a very different definition of terrorism. Turkey is now fighting against those very people who fought with the Western countries and the United States against IS, against ISIS. So there is a contradiction in there. Turkey is already in bad odour with many of its allies because it's being very difficult, holding up various things inside NATO because of its own security concerns. And of course, spectacularly, going off and buying an advanced surface-to-air missile system from Russia, which really is an extraordinary thing for a NATO country to do.
Well, just in the few seconds we have, what do you think might come from this week?
I think it's very difficult. I think NATO was hoping this is a brief meeting. It isn't really even being called a summit by NATO itself. They call it a leaders' gathering. It's only a few hours, and not a great deal is going to come out of it. There isn't going to be a formal communique. But NATO hoped that it would be a very positive event, that it would set the agenda for the alliance going forward into the next decade. The problem is that at the moment, it seems to be very much overshadowed with problems and the baggage that it's been carrying with it over recent months.
Yeah. That's the BBC's defence and diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus, in London. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Well, here in the U.S., the 2020 presidential campaign is well underway, and one thing that candidates are spending a lot of money on is online advertising. On Google alone, political advertisers have spent more than $138 million just since the end of May. But Google recently announced new restrictions on political ads that have some groups upset. Starting next month, campaigns will no longer be able to serve highly targeted ads to specific voters on its platforms. Joining us now for more is Emily Stewart, reporter for Vox. Emily, tell us first of all what exactly Google is changing here, because it does get complicated.
So basically what political campaigns have been able to do in the past is match files that they have on voters. That includes when you voted, if you're registered as a Democrat or Republican, if they have your email address, and find you online. What they're going to do now is say that political campaigns can still target voters, but not as finely. They can use gender, they can use age, and they can use your zip code. So basically, to kind of put this a little bit easier, a campaign can't target me, Emily Stewart, specifically, but they can target a woman who lives at my zip code in Brooklyn, New York, between the ages of 25 and 35.
So what are those in favor of the change saying about why it is so necessary?
Basically, they say that micro-targeting is too specific, and what it allows is for ads to be targeted to very specific groups, and maybe other people are not seeing them. So one example that I think about a lot is in 2016, you had the Trump campaign talking about how they were running ads meant to suppress votes. So they were targeting African-American voters with ads featuring Hillary Clinton in the 1990s, describing some young Black males as super predators. And the point of those ads was to discourage Black voters from coming out to vote. And so basically, if nobody's seeing those ads, then there's no way to counter that narrative. So kind of the idea is that the more people see these ads, the more chance there is for someone else to flag something and say, hey, this is incorrect, or to counter the message.
Now, Bloomberg reports there may be a loophole in Google's policy that the ban on micro-targeting applies to ads placed in Google Search and on YouTube, which is owned by Google, but not on Google Ad Space bought through a third party. Is there a loophole here?
Right. Well, that's sort of what we're figuring out. And when this first happened, I talked to someone who mentioned this to me, that basically when you see display ads, so ads that, you know, chase you across the internet that we all see every day on different websites, those aren't all just sold through Google. They also come from third parties like Adobe. And so just because Google says no micro-targeting doesn't mean these third parties do.
The Trump campaign is not happy about this. President Trump's 2020 campaign manager, Brad Parscale, said Google is stifling the ability of citizens to participate in our democracy. What's their argument?
Well, you know, they are saying that this is a voter suppression effort, which I would argue is probably not the case. You know, Brad Parscale, who's his campaign manager, has made a lot of noise about his ability to micro-target, whether or not you believe that he has some great secret. Who knows? But also, you have to think that, especially on the right and President Trump, they really have sort of set up the tech industry as a villain. They often criticize Google, Facebook for censorship. And so this is also another opportunity for them to stoke the fire around that.
What about Facebook? Facebook is not making these changes like Google.
Right. So Facebook has come under a lot of pressure over their work around political ads. And you could kind of argue that they're the ones that started this back in September when they wouldn't take down an ad that the Trump campaign was running about Joe Biden that was false. And Facebook really has dug its heels in. They're saying, you know what? We are sticking to what we are doing. We are letting political ads go. We are not going to fact check them. there is some rumors and some buzz that they will make some changes. They have said they are not taking anything off of the table, but they also very well may just ride this out and say, you know what, Twitter is making changes around its ad policy. So is Google. We're just going to wait until the fire dies down.
You know, let me just play cynic on this for a second. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg just had dinner with President Trump. The Trump campaign doesn't want these changes. Is it possible that Facebook is not going to put the changes through because they feel that if they do, the Trump administration is going to crack down on Facebook in other ways?
I mean, I think that there's no way to know what was said in that dinner or other meetings. And it is normal for CEOs to meet with politicians, including the president, all of the time. Obviously, Facebook is very sensitive to the criticism they are getting from the right. But honestly, there are Democratic groups that are also setting their hair on fire saying, do not make this change. You know, they seem to just not want to make anyone mad. And obviously, you don't want to make the president of the United States, who is very trigger happy with his Twitter account, mad either.
That is Emily Stewart, a reporter for Vox. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations. Thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
There's a new book out today about Brett Kavanaugh, the newest Supreme Court justice. It is called Supreme Ambition, and it's by Washington Post columnist Ruth Marcus. It details the drama behind his nomination and confirmation last year. Ruth Marcus, let's talk about Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing. Republican Senator Charles Grassley was the chair of the Judiciary Committee. Democrat Dianne Feinstein was the ranking member. She's 86 years old now. And you make the case that she was pretty unequipped to lead the effort to stop Kavanaugh.
Well, yeah. So what I write in the book is that the Democrats had a bad hand and they played it badly if their goal was to defeat Kavanaugh. And what I mean by the bad hand was that obviously they were not in the majority in the Senate. And second of all, it was in the Gorsuch hearings, the previous hearings, that Democrats had pushed Republicans to have to deploy the nuclear option so that there was no longer the possibility of a filibuster. Judge Kavanaugh only needed 50 votes to be confirmed. He didn't need 60 votes. So that's a pretty bad hand. But Dianne Feinstein, who has a impressive record as a senator, was not up to the task. She is the oldest senator, and to be blunt about it, that showed in the course of the hearings.
What did you find out about what Feinstein knew and when about Christine Blasey Ford's allegations? Because Blasey Ford had reached out to a California Congresswoman, Anna Eshoo, who then reached out to Feinstein to tell her about what Blasey Ford was alleging. And then Feinstein in the hearings was accused by the Republicans of sitting on that letter until the last minute.
So Dianne Feinstein was in a very, very difficult situation when it came to Christine Blasey Ford's allegations. But what happened was Christine Ford tried to reach out to Anna Eshoo even before Brett Kavanaugh was chosen as the nominee. It took a while for her to get through. Then she spoke to Anna Eshoo. Anna Eshoo called Dianne Feinstein the next morning. Senator Feinstein said, "That's very serious. Have her write me a letter." And Christine Ford did not hear back from anybody about this for about 10 days. And in fact, Dianne Feinstein had heard this remarkable allegation against this very controversial nominee, didn't even mention it to her staff. Christine Ford was very reluctant to come forward. Dianne Feinstein felt like she needed to promise Christine Blasey Ford confidentiality. That's understandable. But I write in the book that that was a pretty major decision to make without going to any of your leadership, any of your Democratic colleagues, mm-hmm. to just decide on your own that you're going to keep this explosive information to yourself. And especially because information like this has an incredible tendency to leak. And Dianne Feinstein did not plan accordingly for that. And that created the situation in which she was blamed, I think, very unfairly for leaking it and blamed somewhat unfairly for having sat on it. She was in a tough spot.
Well, Ford eventually, of course, did testify. And let's listen to a little bit of her today.
I am here today not because I want to be. I am terrified. I am here because I believe it is my civic duty to tell you what happened to me while Brett Kavanaugh and I were in high school.
That was very powerful testimony. And then later in the day, and I was there anchoring NPR's coverage for 10 hours of that day. And one of the other dramatic moments happened in the afternoon with Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, who said this during the hearings.
You've got nothing to apologize for. When you see Sotomayor and Kagan, tell them that Lindsey said hello, because I voted for them. I would never do to them what you've done to this guy. This is the most unethical sham since I've been in politics.
He's talking to Kavanaugh there. How much of a difference did that speech make?
It did. You know, it was really interesting. And to hear that again, you just are reminded of the anger and the passion of the moment. Both Brett Kavanaugh's outburst and Senator Graham's outburst, for me, they had the impact of scaring me. And I came away thinking, surely he can't be confirmed after that outburst. With Republicans, the impact was precisely the opposite. It was a rallying cry for the troops. Republicans across the country rallied for him.
Were Graham and Kavanaugh also speaking to President Trump when they did that, that this would be something that he would like because he doesn't like to give an inch on anything and would be happy for them to just keep fighting all the way?
I think they were partly speaking to President Trump, but I really think that the impact was more rally the troops and rally the senators, because the Republican senators gathered after Christine Blasey Ford's testimony and they had one of their lunches, and the assessment was Brett Kavanaugh RIP. So they needed a push. One of the interesting stories about whether President Trump was part of their audience actually occurred earlier in that day. The president of the United States was trying to reach Don McGahn, his counsel. Mm-hmm. Don McGahn thought, maybe correctly, maybe incorrectly, that Trump was getting ready to pull the nomination, and so he didn't want to talk to him. This is after Christine Blasey Ford's testimony. And so he's not taking phone calls from the president of the United States, to the point where his deputy reaches out to him and says, hey, the president's trying to reach you. You need to take his call. And Don McGahn told her, I don't talk to quitters.
Can you imagine denying a call from the president of the United
States? I actually cannot.
I'll call him back.
But not just one.
After the Christine Blasey Ford hearing happened, Jeff Flake, one of the moderate Republicans, got the FBI to do another investigation into allegations against Kavanaugh. But from your book and from some of the other reporting about it, it seems like that FBI investigation wasn't a real investigation.
It was not an adequate investigation. It was a dereliction of duty. And it was a dereliction of duty not just on the part of the FBI, but on the part of the Senate. The reason for that is that Don McGahn was bound and determined, as was Mitch McConnell and others, to get Brett Kavanaugh across the finish line. So the FBI investigation, which they didn't want to happen, which they only allowed to happen when Senator Flake and Senator Collins made clear that they were not going to go forward with a vote without an FBI investigation, the FBI investigation was only designed to satisfy those senators. It was not designed to get at the truth. It was designed to get to 50 votes, and it did its job in that sense. But one of the most, I thought, appalling parts of that investigation involved a man named Max Steyer. Max Steyer is the head of an organization here that is ironically dedicated to promoting good government. He's also a college classmate of Brett Kavanaugh's. He told people that he saw Brett Kavanaugh expose himself to someone, a woman, at a party at Yale their freshman year. Not the woman that you've heard about, Deborah Ramirez, who came forward in a story in The New Yorker, but a second woman. And Max Steyer was desperate to get his information to the FBI. He enlisted the help of two former federal prosecutors with good relations to the FBI. They wouldn't talk to him. He tried to reach out to Susan Collins. She says she doesn't remember that, but he was unable to get her attention. Then he reached out to Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. Senator Coons reached out to his law school classmate, Chris Wray, the head of the FBI, and said, "Hey, can you please interview this guy?" That didn't happen. That letter was CC'd to both Senator Grassley and Senator Feinstein. They didn't say, "Hey, who's Max Steyer and what does he have to say that we should know about?" And then finally, Senator Coons was desperate to get this information to people's attention. He reached out to Senator Flake, who he'd been working with on the FBI investigation. Senator Flake said, "I can't deal with it. My family is getting death threats. I have to concentrate on that." So I just thought this was one of the most appalling derelictions of duty that I've seen in my years in Washington.
One other detail I want to ask you about. There's reporting that Ralph Blasey, who's Blasey Ford's father, wrote to Ed Kavanaugh, Brett's father, to say that he was glad that Brett was confirmed. Did that really happen?
It did really happen. Just to set the scene for you, this is the day after Justice Kavanaugh's confirmation vote. And Ed Kavanaugh, who's a member of a fancy golf club here called Burning Tree, opens his email and he finds this email from Ralph Blasey, who is a fellow member and former president of Burning Tree. And Ralph Blasey says in this email, "Both of our families have been through a lot. I'm glad Brett was confirmed." Now, the Blaseys, unlike the Kavanaughs, did not appear with their daughter at the hearings. Behind the scenes, they had been supportive of her. They went to see her at the hotel where she was staying after the testimony. They told her they were proud of her for speaking out and telling her truth. But that's a pretty amazing sentence from a father whose daughter had accused Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her.
So do you think that the Kavanaugh confirmation process is going to change the way that justices are nominated and confirmed? Has it done any lasting damage to the process?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that have done lasting damage to the process. And I would start with getting rid of the filibuster, which was a moderating influence on things. But also more broadly, I think we are just at a moment where there is almost no prospect of having somebody from the opposite party vote for a president's nominee. And that's one piece where actually Lindsey Graham was right. He was right to vote for Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan. And it's truly terrible that we've fallen off that norm and there's no prospect of it being returned. I can imagine a world in which you have a Democratic president and a Republican Senate, or perhaps even the other way around, where vacancies remain open for years. And that'd be terrible.
That is Ruth Marcus, whose new book is called Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. Thorough, terrific reporting. Ruth Marcus, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
California Senator Kamala Harris is ending her presidential campaign. She tweeted today that she does so with deep regret, but that she will keep fighting for justice for the people, all the people. Her departure leaves just 15 Democrats left in the race. NPR senior political editor Domenico Montanaro joins us now with more on this. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Jeremy.
So Senator Harris was the only black woman in the race, considered a top-tier candidate early on. She had qualified for the next debate in December. This is pretty surprising.
It is surprising. She said in a statement that she released this afternoon, said, "My campaign for president simply doesn't have the financial resources we need to continue. I'm not a billionaire. I can't fund my own campaign. And as the campaign goes on, it's become harder and harder to raise money. We need to compete in good faith. I tell you that the path forward, I don't believe that she has one." So, you know, this resources are a big part of running a presidential campaign, especially when you have you're setting out to run a major campaign, as she was. You know, she had a lot of high hopes to begin with. Came out, remember her first rally in Oakland, 20,000 people showed up. A lot of people thought that that might be indicative of something to come. A lot of Democratic primary voters had a lot of good feeling and warmth toward Kamala Harris. They wanted to be able to vote for someone like her. Mm-hmm. They liked her bio. They liked that she was an African-American woman. They liked that she was a senator and that they felt that she had some promise and potential. There is an interesting moment when you look at her polling decline. She was up around 15% in July, according to the national polls, and then really started to nosedive from there. And that time between the first and second debate was really crucial for her to be able to lock in dollars, motivation, momentum. And she was never quite able to do it and then had a real lackluster second debate and was never able to quite recover from that.
Yeah, we remember she went after Joe Biden in the first debate. And then in the second debate, a lot of people started going after her. What does this do to the race, Domenico?
Well, it's certainly the largest name, the biggest person to sort of step aside in this race. And what's been really interesting, she talks about billionaires. You've had Michael Bloomberg spend $50 million of his own money in the over 2 weeks in advertising. And you've seen him vault right now up into fifth place. You know, not a huge number, 3-4% in the polls, but still polling, national polling is a pretty lagging indicator. So, you know, he's right there with almost the top tier, and yet Harris wasn't quite able to pick up mm-hmm. the pace. So you have this clearly defined top tier of Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, and nobody else has really been able to crack that top tier except for Harris at one point, not quite there. Andrew Yang certainly has a strong following. We've seen Amy Klobuchar come up some in Iowa, but that's where your field is.
Well, and we'll see, I'm sure, a lot of tweets, very nice tweets from the other candidates today saying how much they like Kamala Harris and would love her supporters to come to them. Now, just briefly, do you think that she's going to be a top possibility for VP pick by the other candidates?
Oh, not a question. She definitely goes right to the top of the VP list. And I watch somebody like Cory Booker. His, you know, case to make is that if Biden drops, he can win over black voters. Let's see what happens.
NPR senior political editor Domenico Montanaro on today's breaking news that Kamala Harris is dropping out of the race for president. Domenico, thanks.
You're welcome.
And it's Giving Tuesday. Yay, the day to support causes you believe in instead of, you know, box stores. And Karamo Brown is supporting books. Karamo, as many know, is one of the Fab Five on Netflix's Queer Eye, five gay men with different areas of expertise who march into people's lives and leave them forever changed. It's not just a makeover, it's a spiritual experience. And Karamo is the culture expert. While the rest of the guys focus on the outside, he says he works on the inside. Here he's helping one A.J. Brown, who struggled to tell his dad he was gay.
I wish I did tell my dad, but I just couldn't say it.
Do not let that fear hold you. Don't let it hold you anymore. You are the epitome of what it is to be a strong, beautiful, black, gay man.
Karamo is the child of Jamaican immigrants. He came out at 16, but 10 years later found out a former girlfriend had borne their son, Jason. And with the mother's permission, Karamo took full custody of Jason, later adopting his half-brother, Chris, taking 10 years off an entertainment arc to raise them and be a licensed social worker. Now Karamo has written a new children's book, I Am Perfectly Designed, with now 22-year-old Jason. He's teamed up with Pizza Hut and the nonprofit First Book Stories for All Project to increase diversity in kids' books. You can support it, and kids can get free books with a pizza. There's information at herenow.org. Karamo is reading today at Mountain Vista Elementary School in Los Angeles. Karamo, I Am Perfectly Designed. What a lovely title. You know, telling kids they're perfect.
Yes, it is. You know, there's a lot of messages that kids receive and adults that tell you that something about who you authentically are is not enough. You can't achieve this. You can't do this because of where you come from, because of who your family is. And all those things are myths and are wrong. Mm-hmm. And so if we can start to encourage young kids from an early age to have a mantra that they can use to sort of quiet those negative messages, then hopefully we can see more higher self-esteems and less mental health issues because kids are focusing on loving themselves instead of hating things about them.
Yeah, and what about you? I mean, did you always love yourself, or was this a journey for you to this?
Oh, no. I mean, it was a journey that I still practice today. I mean, even as an adult, I remind myself of the same mantra, I am perfectly designed, because there has been some mornings, and anyone can relate to this. You walk out the house, you look good. You're like, oh my gosh, I did the extra work for that project at work. My boss is going to acknowledge me. And then the minute you get out the house, you get a call from a parent or a mother that says, oh my gosh, you're still doing that. You wore your hair like that. Or you get to work and someone has a comment. And then immediately you start feeling down about yourself. And so it's about constantly practicing language that's going to help support lifting up your self-esteem instead of practicing language that's going to knock your self-esteem down. But as long as you know that you have the ability to practice positivity instead of negativity, then you'll be okay.
I have to tell you, people are saying, oh, that's Karamo Brown. That's what he does. I mean, and we should say that on the show, you sometimes are driving people to a location. And so I've heard people say that they are going to refuse to get in a car with you if you ever say you will drive them anywhere, because they'll be crying by the end of the trip. How much do you want other people to feel good about themselves?
It's funny that you just said that. First of all, I got to tell you, because I was thinking, if, you know, television didn't work out and I want to be an Uber driver, because I actually do love driving a lot, I was like, it's never going to work because people will not get in the car with me ever. Ever. Even my own kids now are always like, Dad, I'm not getting in with you. You're not going to have a heart-to-heart with me right now. And I'm like, yes, I am. But I think it's super important for people to feel good about themselves, to be honest with you, because we all have come to a place where social media, some parts of the media, are telling us that we're not good enough. You know, even our show, we try to make sure we balance, like making sure people know that this is not a makeover show. This is a make better, meaning we're just helping you to fine tune the things that are already great about you. We're not changing you all the way over. Yeah. And I think that's really important for people to know.
Do you ever worry that you might get in too deep, though? I want to play a clip from Queer Eye. And again, you know, sometimes you're described as the life coach as well as the culture critic, which in the past has been about, you know, going to museums and looking at artwork, you know. But I'm wondering, you know, you've done things like we're about to hear. You set up for Wesley Hamilton. He's getting this life makeover. And you've set up for him to meet Maurice. Now, the two men apparently were at a party together, and Maurice had been explaining, the shooter had been explaining, that he felt threatened by someone else having a gun, and he was trying to explain what happened. And so we hear Wesley, the shooting victim, speak first. Let's listen.
I could understand why you did what you did. If it was the other way around, I probably would react the same way you did.
I didn't imagine you seeing it from that perspective. Like, it was no malice in my heart.
Wes, do you need an apology?
I don't think it's necessary for an apology. I prefer not you to feel sorry.
Karamo, this is heavy. I mean,
yeah.
You know, you ever worry you have a history of social work, but this sometimes people think these things can go wrong, or maybe they need, you know, more of a professional, a therapist, to be at a meeting like this.
Yeah, I never had that fear, to be very honest with you, because I trust in my skill levels from what I did in my past career before getting in television. And for me, it's always about how can I help the person we're working with, who we call a hero, how can I help them to have emotional and mental growth? And you can cut your hair, you can change your clothes, but if you haven't figured out why you haven't done that in 20 years, after we walk away, you're just going to go back to that. And for this young man, him and his family never found closure from this shooting that altered the trajectory of their lives and someone else's lives. And I knew if they never got closure, this would always haunt them, and this would always be something that lingered, and this would always be something that they continuously went back to. And, you know, it was a big conversation with the network and with everyone of, can we do this? And I just kept saying, trust in me. I'm an expert in what I'm doing. And it worked out phenomenally, having these two men sit across from each other, acknowledge how they both played a part in this. And now to this day, they're still having communication. Wesley, the hero we worked with, who is actually living his life in a wheelchair, you know, is doing extremely well, going around, doing gun advocacy work. I mean, it was impactful. And so many people who had never seen gun violence and understood it got to get a glimpse into something that was new to them. And so I'm very proud of that moment.
Well, and we'll post it at herenow.org, along with ways that people can participate in what you've gotten behind, which is this Pizza Hut First Book Story for All project. You can support this cause by adding a first book donation to your Pizza Hut order. Great excuse to go have pizza, and also a great way to help get diverse books into kids' hands. Yours is that I Am Perfectly Designed. You co-wrote it with your son, Jason, and you mentioned your kids that, you know, maybe they don't want to get in the car to have a talk with you. I hope you don't mind if we ask about Jason. And we understand he identifies as pansexual, you know, not limited in sexual choice. I mean, this is your son. You know, how have you helped him on his path?
To be honest with you, when he identified as pansexual, I didn't understand what that meant. I had to go research it. And this was something. And this
You're Karamo Brown. You're part of the Fab Five. And that's, I think people need to hear that, you know, that it's okay if you don't know about something.
I 100% agree. And that's the reason why I've never been ashamed to say I didn't understand. I had to go Google it. I was like, okay, I don't know what this means. I had some reference point, kind of. But what I did know as his father is that I need to love him unconditionally and make sure that he had the knowledge and tools so that he could have a healthy and happy life. And so for me, I went on an immediate journey as his father to sort researching and figuring out how can I support him, because I think that's what happens, where what should happen with parents is that you should get to a place where you say, you know, this is my child and I want to love them and give them the best life. Because of that, he's making happy, healthy choices and living a life that I'm very proud that he's living.
That's Queer Eyes Karamo Brown getting behind Pizza Hut's backing of First Books Stories for All project. This is curating new diverse books. One of them is his, I Am Perfectly Designed. Karamo, thank you so much for taking time with us today.
Of course. Thank you so much. And I just want to encourage every little kid out there to go get a book, read it, and, you know, a couple books. I was a bookie kid growing up. You can get a free pizza if you read a couple of books, so it's not a bad idea.
Like I said, what's not to like? Karamo, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Chicago's top cop is off the job sooner than expected. In a surprise move yesterday, Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot fired Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson, whose retirement she announced nearly a month ago. Yesterday, she explained her decision for firing Johnson was due to an incident back in October in which he was found asleep in his vehicle while at a stop sign.
It has become clear that Mr. Johnson engaged in a series of actions that are intolerable for any leader in a position of trust, particularly the head of the Chicago Police Department.
For more, we're joined by Chip Mitchell, criminal justice reporter for WBEZ. Chip, Johnson was already on his way out. What exactly is he being fired for?
Well, Jeremy, this October incident, it was 12:30 a.m. He was found asleep in his car. It was running at a stop sign. The next day, he said it had something to do with his medications. But then just a day later, Mayor Lightfoot said Johnson had told her he'd had a couple drinks over dinner. So the city inspector general's office got to work on an investigation on Johnson's conduct, also why he wasn't given a field sobriety test, why he was allowed to drive himself home. But from then, it was really clear that the mayor's office was easing him out. They announced he announced he'd be retiring at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. It was a big celebration. And then yesterday, Jeremy, this sudden news conference, the mayor's office abruptly called. She announced he was fired. She said that there was some evidence out of that investigation that showed he'd lied to both her and the public about the driving incident. She didn't provide any further details. But now it's coming out, and it looks like he had actually spent hours in a bar drinking, you know, some salacious details too with a woman that wasn't his wife. So this is all now starting to come out, Jeremy.
Now, Johnson took over as superintendent back in 2016 after the release of the dash cam footage from that fatal police shooting of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. What was his role in that very controversial period for the Chicago police force?
Yeah, when Johnson took over, we're talking about March 2016, the community, its trust in the police department was at a low point after the video of the McDonald killing. And there were same time rank-and-file police officers, as they were facing increased scrutiny, a lot of criticism, they were complaining a lot about low morale. And there was actually a question about whether they would even perform their duties. At the same time now, the city was having an historic surge in gun violence, more gun violence than that it had seen since the mid-90s. So the main way the city responded, and Eddie Johnson, the superintendent, carried this out, there was a huge expansion of the police department. Johnson also embraced a lot of new technology. He did something else that was very unusual for a top cop in Chicago. He embraced working with community groups that employed ex-offenders to reach out to gangs and mediate deadly conflicts, bring in the guys that were at the highest risk and provide them services and jobs. And, Jeremy, all of those things seem to make a difference against the gun violence.
He actually was able to bring gun violence down in Chicago?
That's right. That big surge that we had, it lasted more than a year and a half. It's been dropping steadily since about August 2017.
So replacing Eddie Johnson will be the former Los Angeles Police Chief Charlie Beck. What do we know about him and the challenges he'll be taking on in Chicago?
Yeah, Beck is the interim superintendent. He's expected to serve for several months. He's the first outsider in decades to serve in this position as interim superintendent, coming in from the outside instead of promoting somebody from the command staff to run the department. So it's really an indication that Mayor Lightfoot sees the bench around Superintendent Johnson, former Superintendent Johnson, as very thin. Now, Beck has led LAPD for 9 years. And one of the important things that he did there was he led his department in Los Angeles to the end of a 12-year consent decree. So that's a court-enforced agreement for police reform. Now, Chicago, Jeremy, has its own consent decree. It took effect just this year in March. Mm-hmm. So that's really Beck's main challenge here, is to move that process forward. The department's already missing a lot of its deadlines early on in this consent decree process. So Beck has got to get the police department behind this process, mm-hmm. rank and filers all the way up to the chain of command for police reform. And that is definitely one of his big challenges here, Jeremy.
That's Chip Mitchell, a criminal justice reporter at WBEZ in Chicago. Thanks, Chip.
My pleasure.
Well, as we wrap up this hour, some news from Spotify. It has released the most streamed songs of the decade. Yes, the decade is over in less than a month. So what is the most streamed song with 2.4 billion streams? It's this, Shape of You by Ed Sheeran.
I'm in love with the shape of you. We push and pull like a magnet do. Although my heart is falling too. I'm in love with your body. Last night you were in my room, and now my bedsheets smell like you. Every day discovering something brand new. I'm in love with your body.
So that was the most streamed song, Robin, mm-hmm. but the most streamed artist was actually Drake, more
that.
Than 28 billion streams. His hits include One Dance, played 1.7 billion times.
Strength and guidance, all that I'm wishing for my friends. Nobody makes it from my ends.
So I was surprised that Spotify had even been around for longer than a decade, but it was in fact founded in 2006.
1.7 billion.
Amazing. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.